This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
All right, thanks for coming. This is really weird to be doing a lecture and Sarah's in the audience and Cara's in the audience, and I'm married to her now. I wasn't always married to her when Sarah was in the audience, so this is good. So if I have a sort of a disequilibrating experience, you'll forgive me. All right. Marsh seemed somewhat surprised that I was going to talk about just war tonight. I was asked to talk about love. I will talk about love, but I'm going to talk about love and war sort of together. Again, I am a happy person, but this is sometimes just what I do. I assume in this crowd it's okay to begin in Middle Earth. All right. I do not slay man or beast needlessly, and not gladly even when it is needed. War must be while we defend our lives against a destroyer who would devour all. But I do not love the bright sword for its sharpness, nor the arrow for its swiftness, nor the warrior for his glory. I love only that which they defend. So says... Sorry? Oh, come on. This is Libri, come on. Who says this? Thank you. Who said that? Okay, she wins the honeypot. All right? So says Faramir, captain of Ithilien, on and on. Faramir, in saying this, intersects love with the cataclysm of war. And indeed, he makes the claim that war can be an expression of love. Now, everything that follows in this talk, hinges on the fact that the Christian ethical life has as its central command this dominical command to love our neighbor. Now, this love command is not an option. It's an absolute mandate. But because of the conditions of this world and of the human soul, it is not always clear precisely how it is that we are to love our neighbor. For instance, how do we love one neighbor when he is unjustly kicking in the face of another neighbor, right? Who we are also called to love. If the first neighbor, let's call him the enemy neighbor, if he refuses to stop his kicking and our victim neighbor is unable to defend himself, then we cannot love both neighbors in precisely the same way, right? But the question is never whether to love one or the other. But what does loving both individually look like now, in this moment? Now, the just war tradition provides guidance in how we are to love in conflict situations, both our enemy neighbor as well as our innocent neighbor. Now, how war might be an expression of love for the assailed neighbor, I think, is reasonably clear. But how can love be an expression of love for the one from whom we are rescuing this neighbor? That seems perhaps a bit less clear. But the Christian intellectual tradition insists it is possible to love even our enemy neighbor, and even as we resist him to the nth degree. That is, it's possible to love our enemy to death. For some, this is all a bit too much. So now let's travel from Middle Earth to Narnia. I assume this crowd, it's also safe to do this. It's a different zip code, but it's similar climate. All right? And depending on how you count it, and I will judge you for how you count the books, this is the second book, all right? In the dead of night, young Caspian, future king of Narnia, stands with his tutor Cornelius atop the central tower in the great castle at the center of the realm. They have come to witness the conjunction of two noble planets. And we'll see them later. I was just going to see if they were there now. They've come to see the conjunction of two noble planets, Tarva, the lord of victory, and Alambil, the lady of peace. These will pass within one degree of each other, and such a meeting, Cornelius instructs his pupil, has not happened for 200 years, and it signals fortune for the sad land, which, we soon learn, manifests in Caspians commanding an insurrection of dwarves and talking beasts in the great war of deliverance that liberates Narnia from the usurping grip of his evil uncle, Miraz. Now, with that in mind, Philip Pullman, sometimes known as He Who Must Not Be Named, the author of his Dark Materials trilogy, which is actually fairly good storytelling, asserted that the Narnian Chronicle, that the Narnian Chronicles is one of the most, this is a quote, is one of the most ugly and poisonous things I've ever read. It demonstrates a sadomasochistic relish for violence, end quote. But quite similarly, a pair of literary critics charged that among the Narnia books, many offenses are, quote, the glorification of conflict and retribution, end quote, and the legitimizing of cruelty. Now, they might have had Prince Caspian particularly in view. Blood, battle, betrayal, maiming, and death feature frequently. My son loves it, right? So do I. Now, indeed, the High King Peter, who's just a schoolboy, is described in one instance as felling an enemy by slashing his legs out from underneath him and then with the back cut of the same stroke, walloping off his head. Yeah. Right? Right. Exactly. All right? It's grim, to be sure. But back to Pullman, he says it's much more. This is Pullman. The highest virtue, we have this on the authority of the New Testament itself, is love. And yet you find not a trace of that in the Narnia books. Right. Be outraged. Come on. Now, heartened, as I'm sure Lewis would be, by this atheist's critique pontificating the character of the Christian Bible, Pullman doesn't have it quite right. Love, that is. For Lewis, the Narnian stories are, of course, all about love. Not about love despite the battles and the wars, but about love that, because it is love, reveals itself in war, and most crucially, in the character of the warriors who fight these wars. But we're going to move to another place. This is more proximate than either Middle-earth or Narnia. And it's a place in which we find a similar, but I think more sober-minded critique, or confusion at least, regarding whether or not love can, in fact, walk the battlefield. In Afghanistan, in September of 2010, by his own admission, then Lieutenant Timothy Kudo, a United States Marine, abetted in the killing of two unarmed Afghan civilians. Now, it was an accident. They had taken fire on patrol. They moved toward the building from which they think the fire came. One group formed a defensive perimeter around it. A second group went inside to clear the building. The group on the outside, after a moment, noticed a motorcycle approaching from a hilltop above their position. So tactically, this gives whoever's on the motorcycle a position of tactical superiority, right? They're in a dangerous position, these Marines. They look up at the motorcycle, they contemplate it. They think they see what could be rifles. They're unsure, so they go through a pre-established protocol to get the motorcycle to stop. It involves, you know, saying, you know, stop, yelling, waving them off, popping smoke, all sorts of things in an escalating sequence to get this bike to stop. At one point, the bike slows down, appears to come to a stop, and then it speeds back up and continues straight at him. It crosses what is called the trigger point, the point beyond which the lives of the Marines are potentially in mortal danger. So the Marines, in this instant, think they see muzzle flashes. They see what they take to be weapons, and they fire. The bullets hit the bodies fall. Timothy Kudo says, as we rushed toward the motorcycle, you know, to examine the bodies, one of his Marines is making a silent plea. Please, let there be a weapon. Please, let there be a weapon, right? There's no weapon. What they mistook for rifles turned out to be sticks with bindles on them. What they took to be muzzle flashes was probably the sun reflecting off the chrome of the motorbike. Right? One of the riders was no more than a teenager. Right? Terrible accident. Now, Timothy Kudo, reflecting back on this, says that he thinks about those two constantly. He's been out of the military for years. Sorrow is the right response. I'm not going to contest that, absolutely. But it's not just those accidental killings that Kudo thinks about. He thinks about all the killing in which he was involved. And he says he was never the trigger puller, per se, so he never directly killed anybody. But he called in airstrikes, he gave permission for snipers to open fire, and these sometimes on people in the process of planting IEDs, or people who were moving tactically toward his Marines with weapons, right? These deaths, too, haunt him. He says this, "When I joined the Marine Corps, I knew I would kill people. I was trained to do it in a number of ways, from pulling a trigger to ordering a bomb strike to beating someone to death with a rock. As I got closer to deploying to war, my lethal abilities were refined, but my ethical understanding of killing was not. I held two seemingly contradictory beliefs. Killing is wrong, but in war it is necessary." And he asks, how could something be both immoral and necessary? And he concludes by saying, "I will never know whether my actions in Afghanistan were right or wrong. On good days, I believe they were necessary." So for Timothy Kudo, growing willing to kill another human being was a diminution of what it means to be a human being. And he says it is a perversion accomplished only via a kind of staggering conversion. To properly wage war, he insists, you have to recalibrate your moral compass. Now, Timothy Kudo's moral concern about killing in war is not, of course, unique to him. If you look for it, you'll see some form of this phrase, that killing is wrong, but in war it is necessary, in combat memoir after combat memoir. You'll see some form of it. Carl Melantis, an American Vietnam-era veteran, also a Marine, says this. He says, "The violence of combat assaults psyches, confuses ethics, and tests souls. This is a result not only of the violence suffered, but it is a result of the violence inflicted as well." You'll also find similar conclusions drawn from within the Christian theological tradition, in which some thinkers believe that sometimes one must do what is morally wrong or morally evil in order to bring about morally good objectives. This is where rhetoric about lesser evils comes from. You'll also find traditions that argue, of course, that love doesn't intersect with the political world, the sphere of power and the deployment of force, at all. And this leads either to bracketing love and simply going on with the business of the state, or opting out of participation in the business of the state full stop. So you'll see it all. Now, unsatisfied with such options, my aim tonight is to try to reconcile love with the Christian duty to care for the world, and especially with a world that is in conflict. I'm going to get a little bit autobiographical now. My own preoccupation with all of this took hold through a study of the Holocaust. I became a Christian through a study of Auschwitz. We could talk about that at some point if you want. Again, I'm a happy person, I really am. I've learned, and I don't mean to be condescending, but I have learned, shockingly, over the last couple years, that I actually have to define, at least briefly, what the Holocaust was, right? The Holocaust was, of course, the attempted annihilation of European Jews by the Nazi regime of Hitler's Germany in World War II. One moment in this whole sort of interaction with the Holocaust stands out. I think it was 1990, I should know this off the top of my head, January 95. It was the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, and I had the opportunity to go up and observe the commemorative events. At the end of the formal ceremonies, they committed to reading the names of all of those lost at Auschwitz-Birkenau, just the one camp. All right, and assuming, back up. So they begin reading these names. My buddy and I tour the camps and we're there for several hours and they're still reading the names the entire time. We decide it's time to go, we start to walk, you know, past the gate, down the tracks, heading back toward this sweet little Polish pub in the center of Oświęcim. So we're heading there, and receding in the distance is still this litany of names. Right? It's been 3, 4, 5 hours. So we're sitting in the pub, the names are gone, you can't hear them anymore, but we start to wonder, if they really did read the names of all the lost in that one camp, how long would they be reading all those names? And I got 14% on the math GRE, but I've had other people check these numbers, and they're apparently correct. if we had the names of all 1.2 million people killed at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and that's a low estimate, and we don't have all their names, but assuming we did, if we had the names of 1.2 million people and it took 1 second to read each name, it turns out that they would be reading that list of names for 13.8 days. All right? 13.8 days, nearly 14 days of an uninterrupted recitation of stolen souls. So, I was a fairly young Christian, listening to all those names, and sitting in that Polish pub, I was absolutely insistent that this new faith had better have something to say about stopping a 14th day, or a 15th, or indeed a first day, or a second day, or a third day. And if it does have something to say about all of that, it would have to be something, I would imagine, that's commensurate with its moral commands. It shouldn't be something antithetical to them. So another way of saying all this is, what does love have to say about stopping a first day of names, a second day, on and on and on? Now, this is not, I think, obviously simply an academic interest. It's deeply personal. Christian political thinking is itself confused and rootless, and I have kids, right? So that makes that confusion deeply personal. America, I'm sure England is completely protected from this, but American culture is awash in confusion, right? We have toxic masculinity nowadays, right? And I'm not going to suggest that some men can't be toxic, and I'm trying really hard not to look at Marsh, right? But when people say toxic masculinity, I don't think they're saying it like they would say, like, toxic waste, where there's some waste that's not toxic, right? Or like the toxic Avenger, right? Toxic masculinity. Masculinity itself seems to be the thing that's toxic. And unfortunately, it's not just sort of the culture out there, right? But it's the American church as well. From the pulpit, you hear confusion. I'm sitting in church, thankfully only with my wife. Our kid is happily ensconced in Sunday school. But the pastor is talking about a husband's duties to his wife. Great topic. I always listen very closely. And he's talking, his main thing seems to be that a husband ought not to use his strength to abuse, belittle, or threaten his wife. I completely agree. That's spot on. But there was nothing in the sermon about a husband using his strength to her good, to protect her, right? Now, he might have meant that, but he surely didn't say it. And so I'm thinking, well, if I'm sitting here with my 12-year-old boy, okay, then he was probably 10, right? But he is just coming into awareness of his strength. He's discovering these things called muscles. And he's discovering that when he takes one of his arms with these muscles and jams it into his dad's stomach, he's getting closer and closer to being able to hurt him, right? And he's thrilled by this. You know, it's fascinating. So my son would be forgiven for sitting there and beginning to doubt that his strength has any kind of a place in the Christian life, right? Just as he's coming into knowing that strength, he picks up in the culture and in the church that this strength is a threat. It's to be feared, not fostered. It's to be checked, not channeled, right? That seems a crime. Now, all of this is important because what is condemned about masculinity, aggression, assertiveness, reliance on strength, competitiveness, are the things that describe not just masculinity, but martiality as well. Both the masculine and the martial virtues are increasingly believed to be in tension with, if not in contradiction to, love. That seems a crisis. All right. So discerning just what Christian love has to say in response to the conditions of the world continues to preoccupy me. And there's a lot to say about all of it. But I'm going to distill much of it into a discussion of three theological concepts that form a framework for Christian thinking about ethics, and then one Christian response to that framework. The three concepts should be familiar: creation, fall, and restoration. And the response to these concepts is responsibility. All right, I'm going to discuss two major thinkers in particular. And again, not to be condescending, but I've learned I've got to actually say who these people are. St. Augustine of Hippo, often considered the father of the just war tradition. He was a bishop in the 3rd and 4th century. And among his numerous writings, we have several long and glorious letters that he wrote to Christian generals in the Roman army. encouraging them both in their faith, but also, crucially, in their martial vocation. The second thinker is Reinhold Niebuhr, a 20th century public intellectual and Christian theologian, who in the build-up to World War II, almost alone, battled the pacifist sentiments and the calls for non-intervention that issued from the mainline churches. Now, Niebuhr had something of a partial resurgence in popularity when President Obama declared him to be his favorite theologian. Niebuhr is also considered the father of modern, the qualification is important, modern Christian realism, which is a mode of political theory that strives to avoid idealism on the one side and cynicism while bringing values to bear on interests as it attempts to act responsibly and prudentially in the conditions of the real world. Now, while the wisdom of both of these thinkers shapes my work, and while both stand in various ways in the Christian stream of realist thinking, Augustine was arguably at its headwaters, they don't always see eye to eye on all the fine points, and we'll get into some of that. First term of the framework, creation. And here, I'm just going to talk about specifically human beings. Genesis 1:26, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, over the livestock, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the ground. Let them have dominion. Now, the meaning of what being made in the image of God entails is found in this mandate to exercise dominion. Well, what is that? Dominion is not domination, right? That's important. It's providential care. It's protective care. It's nurturing care. It's stewardship. Human beings made in the image of God are to exercise care for all of the world. And we're actually supposed to do that now, which is sometimes a point, I think, of confusion. We have a responsibility in history for the conditions of history. Now, further on in the Christian scriptures, we find additional explanation as to what being made in the image of God means. In the beginning of Christ's Sermon on the Mount loom the Beatitudes, these states of blessedness. Now, the first seven of these Beatitudes appear to be character traits that compiled together form a cohort of human beings who are called the blessed. And the blessed are described as poor in spirit, mourners, the meek, those hungry for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, and finally, peacemakers. So it's this last characteristic, the peacemaker, which concludes with a declaration that they will be called sons of God. Now, this is vital and profound. I'll unpack the profundity in just a moment, but first, a parallel comment is important. As I discuss the role of love in political life, I'm inevitably going to be brought into conversation with Christian pacifism. Now, my commentary regarding Christian pacifism might lead you to believe that I don't think very highly of it. And you would be right, all right? But I'm not critiquing my pacifist friends, and I do have them, for fun. I'm critiquing them because I think their pacifism is theologically problematic and not good for them. And so out of love, I push back. Now, more on all of that in a little bit. For now, it's sort of fun to highlight a point of agreement with them. Christian pacifists will often insist that of all the Beatitudes, the call to be peacemakers has a unique muscularity and offers a particularly clear articulation of the Christian vocation and the Christian political witness. I agree. Now, in his much lauded The Moral Vision of the New Testament, the Bible scholar Richard Hayes argues that this injunction to love your enemies, understood especially in light of the Beatitudes, reveals that the act of discipleship necessarily transcends violence. Here's where the disagreement begins. He extends this to Matthew 5:48, where you find, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Hayes follows the traditional view that Jesus' disciples are summoned to the task of showing forth the character of God in the world. Agreed. They're to reflect the holiness of God and scrupulous obedience to the will of God as disclosed through the teaching of Jesus. Agreed. The idea of be perfect is hugely important. It means to be complete or to be that for which you were made, right? The end for which we were made, for Hayes, is nowhere more decisively manifest than, quote, in the practice of loving enemies, which is a practice incompatible with killing them. He writes, the transcendence of violence through loving the enemy issues in the church forming a new community among humanity. And he writes this: "The most salient feature of this new model, instead of wielding the power of violence, the community of Jesus' disciples is to be meek, merciful, pure, devoted to peacemaking, and willing to suffer persecution." And I end quote. In order to participate in this countercultural community, Hayes recognizes that practically speaking, Christians will have to relinquish power or positions of power and influence in so much as the exercise of those positions becomes incompatible with being a disciple of Christ. On that I agree. What he means by incompatible is this. He says, though the governing authority, gesturing to Paul's letter to the Romans, though the governing authority bears the sword to execute God's wrath, that is not the role of believers. Right? So those are the types of positions from which Christians must recuse themselves. All right. Now, I think this is insufficient. The biblical concept of peace is hardly touched if this is what we mean by it. So if that's true, what is peace? Now, I think the operative word in Hebrew is shalom. At its core, shalom designates a state of wholeness or harmony, completeness. It points to the way things ought to be. It's a state in which the lion can lie down with the lamb and doesn't have to be replaced every 15 minutes. Right? All right. Now, the Old Testament prophets used shalom to convey the blessings for God's people associated with the coming of the Messiah. Grounded in the presence of justice and order, conditions which are required for human flourishing, biblical peace is comprehensive welfare extending in every direction. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Bible, shalom is translated as irene, the manifestation of peace. This manifestation, I think, is important. Christians are called to be peacemakers, not just peacekeepers. There's a difference. Now, of course, we need to be careful. The fullness of shalom is out of reach, and we must be careful not to try overly hard to bring it within reach. That's to say, we must not harbor utopian ambitions. I think history, and 20th century history maybe in particular, although the 21st is already giving it a run, history offers a butcher's board of examples of what goes wrong when we fan utopian flames. So that must be avoided. But certain kinds of peace are attainable now. What kinds of peace? My dissertation supervisor, Jean Beth Gielstein, blessed be her memory, said this: everyday kinds of peace. What did she mean? She meant this: mothers and fathers raising their children, men and women going to work, citizens of a great city making their way on streets and subways, ordinary people flying to California to visit their grandchildren or to transact business with colleagues. All of these actions are simple but profound goods made possible by civic peace. They include the faithful attending their churches and synagogues and mosques without fear, and citizens, men and women, young and old, black, brown, and white, lining up to vote on election day. Those kinds of peace. And she wrote all of this shortly after 9/11, when everyday peace seemed in peril. All right, back to the profundity. If shalom is what one is aiming at when one is aiming at peace, then the practical ramification of Christian pacifism's version of peace is a far cry from the peace that's intended by the Sermon on the Mount. There, understand, peacemakers look like God. Remember, blessed are the peacemakers, Jesus proclaims, for they are to be called sons of God, just as those who love their enemies are to be called children of God. Now, as we've already noted, the Beatitudes are presented as a cumulative character description, the constituent elements of which, poor in spirit, meek, mourning, hungering, thirsting for righteousness, pure in heart, all of that, roll together, each gathering into the other until they form a comprehensive aggregate able to be called a son of God. Now, this is really saying something. In Semitic thought, sonship is used figuratively to signify the idea that a person shares the qualities, the nature, of the fatherly figure signified or specified. So to be a peacemaker is, and to be one who loves the enemies, is to display the character of God, including the peacemaking qualities of God. So here a very good first question is to ask, what kind of peacemaker is God? How does he love his enemies? Now let's summarize God's biography by saying that he shows peacemakers to be those who confront hard issues with integrity, who confront hard issues with integrity in order to end hostilities and to allow the opportunity for adversaries to be reconciled. The cross, it seems to me, did precisely this. On Golgotha and elsewhere, God's career in peacemaking makes plain that the establishment of right relationships between fallen people and between fallen people and their God is both always the intended aim and is never easy. The confrontation does not mean the abdication of Christian love. Far from it. And again, consider the cross to see why. D.A. Carson writes this. He says, both God's love and God's wrath are ratcheted up in the move from the old covenant to the new. These themes barrel along through redemptive history, unresolved until they come to a resounding climax in the cross. Do you wish to see God's love? Look at the cross. Do you wish to see God's wrath? Look at the cross. Now, this is why the pacifists claim that the Christian ethic of love involves the rejection of violence seems so untenable. It is Jesus, after all, who speaks more of hell than anyone else. It is Jesus who shows anger in action at the temple desecration or his harsh denunciations of the devouring of widows. He might say, turn the other cheek when someone strikes you, but as Paul Ramsey suggested, one way to get at what this means is to ask if he intends that you would turn the neighbor's cheek too, so that your neighbor's assailant can hit his other cheek. And if that seems strange, then that might have to qualify what he's talking about. Now, if we don't think Jesus meant this, then we need to re-examine our own assumptions about what turning my own cheek might mean. You know, D.A. Carson goes on to say, it's not for nothing that Psalm 2 warns us to beware the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way, nor that in the end of it all, the Lamb that was slain returns as a heavenly warrior with a sword for striking down the nations that war against him. Obviously, there's a lot of symbolic imagery there, but the symbols must still be true. Now, it seems that Christians, particularly evangelicals, tend to get themselves in a bind when they point to Jesus as a model for the moral life. It's not that I dispute this in principle, but the practice of it is full of peril, and it requires immense qualifications. What are we supposed to follow, right? Is it unacceptable for Christians to marry? Well, Jesus did not, and thus there's a long-standing tradition emerging in certain Christian communities that teach that celibacy is indeed a part of the demand to follow Christ. Many of us have rejected that. Thank God my wife has. Are we supposed to follow his lead, as Gideon Strauss cheekily says, in adopting first century footwear? Right? Well, no. It seems to me that the call to follow Jesus is primarily about the possession of a willingness to suffer, even at the sacrifice of our lives, as we obey God's commands, and as we, through this obedience, seek to love our neighbor, including our enemy neighbor, as we love God and as we love ourselves. So the question then at any one point in a Christ follower's mind is going to be something like this. How do I love my neighbor now in these circumstances given the options that I have? And in conflict situations, as we've noted, we cannot love both the victimizer and the victim in precisely the same ways, but we are to love them. The biblical witness, including the love of Christ, helps to show us how. Now, the biblical witness shows that there is nothing impossible about wrath and love being directed toward the same individual or people at the same time. It is right to be angry at injustice. St. Paul's injunction is helpful. He says, insofar as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Now, this shouldn't be misunderstood. Yes, insofar as it depends on you is a commitment to force as a last resort. Yes, we are to do whatever we legitimately can to make peace with our enemies, including praying that God would work in their conscience and ours to stand down, if possible. More than this, we are also to take those early and positive steps to do good in the world, to alleviate, where we are able, cause for grievance or animosity or the bitterness that comes from injustice. We're supposed to do it all. Nevertheless, there are indeed no sure ways to soften hard hearts, and the practice of peace has restrictions. insofar as it depends on you, is not just a spur toward non-kinetic resolution, it is also a limit. You, given who you are, created to carry the image of God, are called to preserve peace. But you, given who you are, have no call or right to ignore continued injustices, nor to trump the veto of those who refuse to reciprocate your peaceful offerings. Our enemies have a vote whether peace will prevail. Now, important, this doesn't disqualify St. Paul's command because the conditions of history. Because of the conditions of history, peace work might involve kinetic action. It might involve force. It's been put this way. Struggle, confrontation, partisan engagement. We bring peace today when we enlist people in warfare against evil struggles. The circle of right relations, that is, peace, will often, in a crooked world, be relations that pass through struggle and confrontation. All right. The second piece of the framework, the fall. I'm not going to have to say a lot about this because this is empirically self-evident. A preliminary task of religious ethical reasoning is to acquire as accurate a description of the facts on the ground as possible. Taking the world as it is a central commitment of Christian realism. Now, we see that evil exists, and I don't think we need to be super sophisticated about what we mean by evil. The political manifestation is the hunger to dominate other human beings. History attests that the capacity for and the inventiveness of human evil is nearly limitless. The extent to which neighbor has consumed neighbor is staggering. We were made in the image of God, but we've disfigured ourselves. So the fall, the great sorrow, the reality of human malevolence, is a critical element of religious ethics. Now, because these are the conditions in which our political policies must operate and in which they must be effective, we have to recognize them. If we get reality wrong, our ethics follow. But it's important to linger over another caution. We must avoid either of a set of cousin errors. And I think you're at the end of term, so you should have already heard Marsh talk about these things. We must avoid both sentimentality or romanticism and cynicism. We must not sentimentally downplay human evil, but we must also not cynically downplay human goodness. Both these qualities are marbled within us. Evil is not the whole story. Yes, the human race includes Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Bin Laden, but it also includes Mother Teresa, Alvin York, or Oscar Schindler. Now, in the Pittsburgh synagogue attack last October, someone quoted Mr. Rogers. Okay, do I date myself when I say Mr. Rogers? Some of you are older, as old as I am. So Mr. Rogers, somebody quoted Mr. Rogers in light of the Pittsburgh synagogue attack. Mr. Rogers apparently once said, "When I was a boy and would see something scary in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.'" Right, and here there's a pause we can make in New Zealand during the mosque attacks, right? And in the response afterward, you have here in England a guy, I had to write his name down because it should be proclaimed, Andrew Greystone. Anybody know who Andrew Greystone is? Marsh does now. Andrew Greystone is this little old man who stood outside a mosque in Manchester with a sign that said, "You are my friends, and I will stand here while you pray." Right? Okay? A helper. Right? Look for the helpers. The point is simple. Even as we remember and respond to moral evil, we must also remember, endorse, and promote moral heroism. And how we behave in the world, the risks we're willing to take, must take into account both facts. Now, Reinhold Niebuhr knows this. In his response, his writings and teachings offer a full frontal assault on both those who feel either that the religious obligations require them to refuse to participate in political or military work, as well as those who feel that military or political work should proceed without being limited by moral requirements. However, how Niebuhr reconciles this, I think, is how he reconciles love and war, I think, is terribly problematic. Now, remember, I suggested that Timothy Kudo, our Marine, was channeling Niebuhr when he says that killing is wrong, but in war it is necessary. Without getting too far into the weeds, Niebuhr believes that there are two laws that are always operative on Christians, and they come into conflict in this world. The first is the law of love. The second is the law of responsibility. The law of love is simple. It's non-resistance to evil. Niebuhr thinks the pacifists are too soft. Non-violence? No. Jesus teaches non-resistance. You don't resist evil, period. The second law is responsibility. The law of responsibility is resistance to evil and the rescue of the innocent. The first law, the law of love, Niebuhr calls the impossible possibility. You can't do it. If you pursue love in this world, you'll get neither love nor responsibility. He says, to devote oneself exclusively to determining and proclaiming the right thing to do is most probably to render oneself powerless in the actual course of events. You'll be neither loving nor responsible. However, if you pursue responsibility, Niebuhr insisted, you'll get a little bit of each, because we can confront evil, we've seen this, and we can do it in a way that is qualified, at least, it's seasoned by love. So for Niebuhr, the Christian realist insists that the ideal principle must be sacrificed to guarantee its partial realization. Niebuhr says, we must strive for justice even when it is forced to use means such as self-assertion, resistance, coercion, and perhaps resentment, which cannot gain the moral sanction of the most sensitive of moral spirits. So it might injure our Christian conscience to put the law of love on the back burner, but for Niebuhr, this cannot be helped. He writes, we cannot refuse to make a decision between political answers to a problem simply because each answer is discovered to contain a moral ambiguity. We are responsible for making choices between greater and lesser evils. All right, lesser evils. We could have a whole conversation about this, but I'm just going to indulge in a modest comment. What for Niebuhr are the lesser evils? Going back to the other quote, we find things like actions that emerge out of self-assertion, resistance, coercion, and resentment. These are the things that he thinks moral sentiments cannot morally endorse. If those sound a bit like the banned characteristics of toxic masculinity, I don't think it's an accident. Because those things, according to Niebuhr, go against the law of love, they cannot be moral, but they might be responsible. Niebuhr does not believe that you can exercise moral responsibility in this world without incurring moral guilt. Now remember Timothy Kudo, killing is always wrong, but in war it is necessary. If you want to talk about it, the Q&A, that attitude has led to a dramatic uptick in the number of suicides among U.S. combat veterans. It's deadly poison. Now, Niebuhr appears to articulate the tacit belief of many in our culture, both religious and secular, and we are not morally comfortable, it seems, with morally comfortable or confident about judgments that lead to force, to confrontation, and to lethal action. Now, getting back on surer ground, C.S. Lewis understood this temptation. When people think about love, Lewis said, they often confuse it with kindness, the desire to see others happy. Not happy in this way or that way, but just happy. He writes, love is sometimes more stern and splendid than mere kindness. There is kindness in love, but love and kindness are not coterminous. And when kindness, in the sense given above, is separated from the other elements of love, it involves a certain fundamental indifference to its object, and even something like contempt for it. Kindness, says Lewis, does not concern itself so much with whether its object becomes good or bad, but only that it escapes suffering. But love would rather see the object suffer much than be happy in contemptible and in estranging modes. So the warfighter, like the surgeon, knows that on occasion a hard thing has to be done to prevent the advent of an even harder thing. For Lewis, the condemnation, punishment, and possible killing of an enemy can be an act of love only if we remember that we believe the human soul is eternal. He writes this, therefore, what really matters is those little marks or twists on the central inside part of the soul, which are to turn it in the long run into either a heavenly or a hellish creature. Now, in this, Lewis is fully aligned with both the just war and the chivalric tradition. Um, He asserts that unchecked wrongdoing may well lead to the happiness of sinners, as Augustine called it, but it is a false, macabre parody of happiness. And therefore, when restraining a wrongdoer by forcing him to stop, by deterring him from resuming, and ideally by provoking the wrongdoer into thinking again and changing his aggressive ways, we work toward the promotion of the only possibility for his true flourishing. And this belongs to his own good, even if it should cost him his very life, says Lewis contra Pace Niebuhr. Now, in such a vision, the Beatitudes enter the same, I think, conceptual orbit. Now, the term blessing in the Sermon on the Mount requires maybe some nuance. In the Vulgate, the Latin term for blessed can be translated happiness, but this doesn't point to a subjective feeling, but rather to an objective fact. So, as in the American Founding Fathers' Declaration, sort of the M exit, I think, right? They said that we're all endowed with our Creator to the right to the pursuit of happiness, and this points, I think, to something similar. The founders weren't pledging their lives and sacred honor to the right of Americans to enjoy a gassy kind of happiness, the kindness that Lewis is talking about, that could be attained in this or that kind of way. Happiness has a peripatetic connotation. It points to the enjoyment of those conditions that allow human beings, made in the image of God, to flourish, to become that for which they were made. And it requires a specific ecosystem to nurture and to create children of God. And so Jesus and Jefferson wants us to be happy, but both are pointing to an objective reality, not a subjective feeling. Now, wonderful, but maybe rare, is the life or occasion in which both the objective and the subjective come together. All right, the third term of our restoration, it was going to be just war. And I'm going to skip it, because I served myself more than I can eat in an hour. So I'm going to skip the entire conversation on just war. And if that titillates you, that's great. We have a big Q&A coming up. All right? But there's got to be something in here that I do want to get to. We'll just skip it. The fourth term is restoration, or is responsibility. The fourth term is a subset of restoration, it's responsibility. You can subtitle this The American Sword, and it's the Spider-Man ethic. Gene Elshain used to talk about political responsibility being with great power comes great responsibility, right? She liked her Spider-Man films, or her superhero films. This requires a longer conversation as well. In short, God has power. Power is good. It's a basic good of political life. Not everybody believes that nowadays. John Lennox, maybe somewhere in this library, has a great talk on the importance of power. Power has gotten a bad reputation in our rather effete and sometimes feckless age. Power can be, like any human good, abused, but abuse doesn't invalidate the proper use. And so the question is always going to have to be something like, how should power be used and to what end? Returning to the Sermon on the Mount, one of the first terms of the sermon are blessed are the meek. All right, we're going to get to what meek means in a moment. Meek has a lot to do with the use of power. You see the same thing in superhero films. Do you watch superhero films? I hope you do. You don't? Oh, you should. I used to be like, Marsh, don't watch superhero films. You have to see them. Superhero films are all about the cultivation and deployment of power to the common good. And the best superhero film, which is also one of my top two favorite Westerns, is Logan. All right? If you haven't seen Logan, do yourself a favor and check it out. It's really graphic and really horrible in a lot of ways. Philip Pullman would not like it, but you should see it. Maybe because of that, you should see it. In Westerns and in Logan, it's all about how controlled violence is sometimes necessary, as seen in the Just War analysis, which we didn't do, for bringing about the conditions of justice, order, and peace. Now, in Westerns, civilization has to somehow be cajoled out of a kind of Hobbesian universe, right? You have chaos, you have everything going asunder. What do you do? It's like Jack Wolf's The Sea Wolf. If you've not read The Sea Wolf, do yourself a favor and read The Sea Wolf. Wolf Larsen sort of portrays the Hobbesian view. He says that life is a ferment, it's a yeast, right? It's consuming everything in its movement and its struggle for its own existence. Out of this sort of yeast comes the man of violence. He enters into the chaos, he corrects the wrongs, right? He demonstrates the proper use of power, the fact that with great power comes great responsibility. And then what do they do to him in the end of a cowboy film? What's that?
He rides off.
He rides off. Some say, oh, he rides off into the sunset. Oh, it's so dramatic and beautiful. Yeah, in the best of the Westerns, he's not riding off into the sunset as sort of this romantic hero. They've more or less said, no, thank you for your help. Get the hell out. Right? Because there's no place in civilized society for guys like you. Right? Nowhere is this clearer than in Logan. Nowhere is it clearer than in my first favorite Western, which is Once Upon a Time in the West. Got to see it. The superhero ethic, unlike that pastor, teaches my son what to do with his strength. So I love him. He learns that the expression of his strength can be a positive good and not, pace niber, a lesser evil. Logan deploys violence to rescue the oppressed when nothing else will. He also fights for those quotidian goods that Elstein cared about. And maybe in closing, I want to show, how do I make the magic happen? All right, anybody know what this is? Venus and
Apollo, I said.
Close. Hello. Venus and who?
Adonis.
Adonis. Oh, yeah.
No, no. Anybody else?
Mars.
Thank you. She gets the other half of the honeypot. Okay. This is Venus and Mars by the Renaissance master Sandro Botticelli. It is in your National Gallery. You should go and see it. It's in the Sainsbury Gallery. It's a beautiful painting. If you read the National Gallery website and listen to some of their tour guides, they will tell you that this represents the fact that love conquers war. All right? You can kind of see it, right? Venus is awake, Mars is out, right? Sort of in their post-coital moment, he's been conquered, right? Here's my problem with this interpretation, that this is love conquers war. C.S. Lewis, apparently, this is all hearsay, but I got it from a book, so it must be true. C.S. Lewis supposedly hated paintings. Like he didn't, his walls, but you go to his house, this seems to be, challenged. But apparently he didn't have a lot of artwork on his walls or in his home or in his office. But somebody said that this was one of the few paintings he did, in fact, have in his office or a facsimile of it. So I'm dissatisfied with the idea that Lewis, who apparently didn't like art like this, nevertheless had this particular painting in his office, if this painting really does represent the idea that love conquers war. Lewis, confessedly unenthusiastic about paintings in general, I don't think would go in for something so sort of garishly sentimental. Now, if you dig around for an explanation, you find in one of his letters to a friend the following musing. He says, in a certain juncture of the planets, each planet may play the other's part. Now, turning back to the Botticelli, you see that this suggestion has some purpose, right? Mars has lost much of his martial aspect. He's been dispossessed of his armor and his lance. He's been euphemistically unmanned. He is defenseless as he slumbers, almost fully exposed. Venus, however, appears to have taken up the martial character. Now, she may not be merely watching Mars, but watching over him. She's acquired her lover's helm and his lance. They're now in her perspective, right? The little satyr is kind of holding it. She's got, he's holding the lance, but they're positioned as if she were. Each does seem to play the other's part. But the reversal, I think, is incomplete. Venus is still Venus, right? She's still, sorry wife, physically beautiful, right? She's delicately eroticized. I don't know if you can quite see this. See that hand? It's sort of, it's pulling up the cloth under its fingers. I think that cloth is on its way, right? It's moving. It's going up her leg, right? Why? One can see the folds beginning to gather beneath her fingers as she pulls. Precisely what she has in mind may be suggested by the satyr over Mars's head, who's about to blow a conch shell in his ear, right? He's going to wake him up. All right, his he is still, my son disputes this, but he is still recognizably the war god. He's well muscled. My son says, no, he's not. Look at him. All right. Back in the day, he was well muscled. All right. His strength remains at hand, however immediately latent. Some have suggested that his very nakedness, while at one level suggesting vulnerability, might actually in the Renaissance imagination rebound as a sign that he was in total control, even when most vulnerable. All right. So accounting for the resilient self-possession, Lewis described how Renaissance depictions of inverted relationships in images of cosmic order, so when the planets absorb one another's characteristics, in such relationships, where such relationships are meant to convey mutual reconciliation. All right. So it's not as if one is triumphing over the other. They are being reconciled. And this idea is born out, I think, in the name of Venus's and Mars' offspring that comes from this union. What is the name of their daughter? Anybody? Concordia. Harmonia, right? Harmony, peace. I promised you a comment on meek. Rather than love overcoming war, we see this reconciliation. Meek in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, right? As a philological refresher, the term meek is, I think, out of style nowadays. Actually, it might be coming back in style in this era of toxic masculinity. Meek sounds like weak, right? Hardly a quality maybe worth cultivating. Jesus, of course, paints a perplexing image when he says, if this is what it means, that the meek are blessed. Meek used to reference a war horse, right? It was a word that referenced the strength of a war horse under the rider's control. All right, and a war horse was something else. I had to look this up. A war horse could propel its 2,000 pounds up to 35 miles an hour, right? That's pretty good. It could smash through and scatter enemy formations. A war horse could also instantly respond in the din of battle. It could kick, it could bite, it could bash, right? All under the control of the lead of its rider. So meek isn't weak. Meek is power under control. And so here, I think you have the strength of Mars under the control of the love of Venus. That, for Lewis, if you read his long essay on chivalry and the medieval knight, that's what he's after there. He calls Lancelot, or he quotes Mallory, who calls Lancelot the meekest and the fiercest of knights, right? Meek in hall when it was appropriate, fierce in battle when required. I think Lewis loved this painting because I think that this depicts the medieval concept of the knight, right? This is the just war warrior. It is strength under control. It is not love in conflict with justice. It is love and justice reconciled. The other piece that I'm going to skip is whether or not any of this is possible in the practical world. It's lovely that it's here. You can have justice and ferocity under control of love, but can love walk the battlefield in that way? And I think if you read the memoirs of certain soldiers, I think you see that love can, in fact, walk the battlefield, and I'm more than happy to get into some of that.